You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Well, hello, Scott, and welcome to the 12th edition of the podcast. Well, it's actually 12B because you don't want this to have a 13. I could care less. I've got no sense of...
Well, actually, it's really terrible, actually, because I was born on the 13th. So there's no superstition in it at all. It's just... I just don't want to jinx our podcast because we're...
Jinx.
Our podcast.
What could go wrong?
You're on about, and I'm getting fantastic feedback about the last few, with the LGBT one and the one previous to that we did with Knavish, and the one that we just the two that we just listened to, because you had split them because you went on and on and on with Mr. T.
He was leaving.
Honestly. I know, and to think, you know, that's what my one-to-ones were like. It's just him talking about it. No, I'm joking. They were not like that.
An hour.
Although
with
I
you.
Do, yeah, I do have a bone to pick with you, Thor, because you said about mugs and tuck shop money, naughty.
I know you told that's me all that in confidence, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and you went and mentioned it seriously because he doesn't have a mug. Well, he does. It's me. Well, it was me.
I'd like to think that he drinks from a ram's horn, like a goblet, sat in a dueling crusted root chair, demands that people bring him gifts.
He really does. He really does. Yeah. I'm getting some really good feedback on our podcast, and I just don't want to jinx it, to be honest with you, because I think that, you know, we do them off our own back, in our own time, and I enjoy doing them, and I enjoy hearing feedback when I'm at.
Do you not get paid?
For which part? The
all
podcast.
Right. Just quickly
it's
moving
not,
on.
Anyway, next part of what you've got on.
Anyway, that was Banterama in full swing, wasn't it?
We are back. We are back. And I think it is worthwhile to say that we've both been extremely busy this last couple of weeks with one thing and another. And it is nice to kind of be back to kind of reviewing a podcast that you did an interview with Mr. T. So,
yeah. So what did you make of the first half?
I thought, to be honest with you, I listened to them both one after the other, and I thought they were both quite honest, open, frank, and that's kind of the Hugh that I know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I think that he's done a difficult job, and I think that regardless of how we think adoption is in England, and I'm saying England because we live in England, that's not to discount, obviously, the nations. But I think, I appreciate what he's done for us as adoptive parents, regardless of whether I've worked for him.
I tried not to be sycophantic, but I just thought, actually, I've seen him on lots of different things. You see him on the telly, on the radio, you hear him, and you think he's very well...
He's famous. He's famous.
He's world famous in adoption in the world. He's very good at communicating his message. He's a great apologist for adoption. He's a great at getting across specific points. But it didn't feel like that when we had the interview. It felt much more like a conversation. And I was really pleased because I didn't want this kind of pat answers to things. And he was very candid. So I was really pleased with that.
Now, I was just going to say, between you and me, obviously, you know, because you'll edit, but I know you will. But when I had my one-to-one with him, he asked if I'd listened to the podcast. And he said that actually he felt so comfortable doing it that he was worried about what he said. But actually, I assured him. I said, you know, obviously, I enjoyed it. I thought that it was very honest and open, and I didn't think there was anything in there that, you know, was of any concern.
No, it was really candid, and I just think it's interesting to get the perspective of someone who isn't an adopter, who's kind of quite immersed in our world. I suppose it's very personal, and his career has kind of come to a, not a pinnacle, but it's
dead end. He's retired, isn't he? Yeah. You know, that's it. He's on his bike and he's That's it. By the time with his coffee mug
comes out, he'll be shuffling around Levi's fixing punches.
And his slippers. Now there's a vision. There's a for vision. Us. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. His onesie.
Oh dear. Oh dear. Oh well, please, you know stop. What?
Should we release this one after he leaves?
Yeah, I think we should.
That would work, wouldn't it? That'd
the thing good. Is, and this is the thing about Hugh, and I will say this, I've gotten to know him quite well over the 2.5 years that I've worked with him, and I think you probably have as well, actually. Obviously, uh-huh. You've not worked yeah. in the same organisation, but you've worked alongside him. And he has probably a very similar sense of humour. And that was the one thing that did come out in both the kind of half hours that I listened to, because when you mentioned Desert Island Discs, and he just instantly came back, and that is what Hugh's like. He doesn't stop to think. He's very humorous, and actually, I think that's why I kind of connect with him. And on, you know, there's different levels, isn't there? I mean, there's me as an adoptive parent thinking, yeah, you've done a lot for us as adoptive parents. There's me as an employee that thinks, actually, I respect you as my CEO, as my manager, as, you know, whatever. And then there's the other part that actually, you know, actually, if I met you in a pub and had a chat with you and a drink, I would actually get on all right with you, you know. And that's kind of the level that I see him on, so.
Well, my first memory of getting to know Hugh sounds like an obituary. Was that he brought me a pint of beer and I couldn't finish it.
I remember you telling me that.
I'm so embarrassed. That's probably a nice way. Shall we put the interview on and then yeah, put it on, that I
stick
it
on, because they're all wondering what we're listening, what we've listened to.
Who?
Yes.
Who? You?
Who? Who?
Never yeah. heard of him. There he was, gone. Okay, we'll put it on and we'll have a chit-chat at the end. I mean, I am intrigued as to know why you're resigning when you're clearly so bothered. Not resigning.
Bothered.
I'll let you think about that. What are you going to do with yourself?
People keep asking me that question. There's a light bulb upstairs I need to change, and my shower started leaking. So that's two things I'm going to be doing in the first week of April. Seriously, I have always, not always, for a long time, I have seen myself moving from full-time employment at around about this sort of age. It's varied at times when I've stressed out. I thought, right, I'll go at 55. When I got to 55, I thought that's ridiculous. But I want to have the ability to continue to do things that make a difference that I'm passionate about, but not tied into then what's inevitably the constraints and the stresses and demands of having a full-time job, running an organisation, everything that goes with that. And I want to be able to spend more time sort of, you know, attending to my needs. You know, things have changed for the better, I think, in terms of the adoption landscape. But running an adoption charity over the last 4 years, not just for me, for others, it's been incredibly stressful. All of us have made at least 25% of our staff redundant over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I've had to make a higher proportion of staff redundant than that to enable the organisation to survive. And what I've had to do is sort of balance the imperative to be sort of running a business, making sure that it survives in a very sort of turbulent environment, and also trying to be out there doing what, you know, our members expect us to do in terms of making a difference.
And that's, I guess there's a lot of stuff we don't see going on behind the scenes. You've got to ensure the longevity and the sustainability of the charity, which nicely leads me on actually to Scott's next question. It's a financial question, the figures here. He said, now that your Took Box bill, the office Took Box bill, has reached three figures, are you going to pay it off before you leave?
Of course, yeah. I always pay my debt.
He'd be pleased about that. No, I'm being facetious. I asked Scott if I could use his name in vain, and he said yes.
I'm a little worried about what he might have planned for me for the rest of the time I've got, the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, there'll be all kinds of japes and tomfoolery and things. I guess it's been an interesting time. Do you think that it's been a successful, your tenure, 5 years?
I will. I think I've achieved things. I think I've achieved things in terms of developing Adoption UK as an organisation. It's been tough, but the people I speak to internally talk about it being a more cohesive, more focused, more ambitious, more successful organisation than it was previously. So I think each person that comes in and leads an organisation will never take it to the next stage. So I think I can look back on achievements there. More importantly, I think I've enabled the voice of adopters in different ways to come more directly into the development of policy at a national level, the development of sort of service design and delivery and practice at a more local level. So the thing I'm most proud about is Adopter Voice, which was my idea, formed by what I was seeing and what I was hearing. And I was in a hotel room in Croatia writing the bid for it, because I went over to do an adoption conference in Croatia.
As you did.
Unusual thing, up against the deadline. So I sort of stayed up most of the night writing the bid. It was successful. And I think, for me, I talk about that being a game changer, because the government's written about Adopt a Voice and its vision for adoption in 2020. People talk about it all the time now. There's other voices that need to be heard, the voices of birth parents and children and so on. It's been my job to try and ensure that Adopt a Voice is central to decision-making. And I think we've moved from people paying lip service to that to people beginning to see that there's a real value in doing that. And you've been involved in that yourself. And you know that you're listened to and that what you say informs thinking and begins to change things. I think you know that.
Yeah.
You're looking as if you don't...
No, I'm thinking about that because I am always really cautious about the phrase, but that's perhaps my own political bent and I sit in the woods and ponder these things. That I sometimes worry that as adopters we hog the adoption narrative. Because we are part of that, you know, infamous triangle. It's not a triangle, is it? It's a strange shape because social services are in there as well, so it's a square. And I'm slightly conscious that sometimes I meet adopters who I think, I don't agree with you. I mean, not that I don't agree with you. I think that you are way off beam. So I think that that's the difficulty, that we don't speak with one voice, that, you know, some people would run away with their children and play nice forever and shut the door. I know adopters who haven't told their children they're adopted. Right. So that's my caution, is that people have conversations with me that worry me.
I've heard adopted parents say things that I've just thought, that's just not right. I can't support that at all. People ask me to do things and I'm thinking, I just say, well, no, that's not what they believe. So you're always dealing with, aren't you, a range of different sort of perspectives and so on. But what I was seeing when I came into Adoption UK was a very, very polarised position of the majority, many of our members and a lot of my staff who were adopters, hugely anti-professionals. Yeah. And professionals just completely closing their ears to all this noise they were getting from what they saw as slightly unhinged
people. You know?
Yeah. And that sort of blessed it really, a lot in the way I've described it. But actually, there's a lot of sort of, it was a polarized thing. And what I've tried to do, which is what I always do in different roles that I have, is to sort of understand where those polarised perspectives are coming from and to try and find a way of building the middle ground so you end up actually with a proper conversation about the important things, understanding there may well be different perspectives, but you've got to, you know, you're only going to make progress. I'm only going to make progress in children's interests if people stop shouting at each other or stop sort of putting their fingers in their ears and understand each other's perspective and then find the way forward. And I did say, you know, I don't think the child's voice is heard well enough. I don't think adult adoptees' voice is heard enough. I don't think birth parents' voice is heard enough. It's been my job to bring adopters' voice forward. And I do talk about lack of those other voices in public settings. But for children who are adopted from care, it's the adoptive parent who's the main agent to change. It's the adoptive parent who knows that child better than anybody else. It's the adoptive parent who's going to be the continuity for that child until that parent dies. And so that voice is a really, really important one. When that voice says something that's not in the child's interest, I think it's absolutely right that then professionals challenge that.
And I guess there's an element of gatekeeping that voice that, you know, that the organisation Adopt a Voice has to do, has to kind of ensure that we don't allow people with fringe views, or, well, not fringe views, cause, but views that are not right. You know, make judgment calls on some of those views.
Yeah, and right or wrong, not everybody I know agrees with this, but in establishing Adopt a Voice, which is like a sort of formal thing, as it's funded by the government at the moment, and I wanted something that brought the adopted family's voice into policy discussions and so on in a way that was credible. So, as you know, we recruit volunteer champions. We have a professional team led by Scott, all of whom are adopters, sort of facilitating this. And we only select people to be Adopt a Voice champions if we feel that they can reflect well the views of others and work through the fact that there'll be different views, so they're advocates for a community rather than sort of having a very particular perspective which is just about their own sort of personal situation and the sort of highs and lows of that. Because it's an advocacy role, therefore you need people not only who've got their own personal experience of this, but are able to sort of understand the perspectives of others and to put that forward.
Yeah, I mean,
and of course, their own perspective comes into it, but they can't just talk about their own story, because otherwise you just get a whole load of people talking about their own story. You don't understand what the bigger set of issues are.
Yeah, and I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the difficulty is people finally get an opportunity to speak and they want to tell their story. And we've moved on from that adopters are kind of getting savvy to that actually they need to speak in a bit more generic terms to reinforce their voice.
Yeah.
My instinct is to shout. And, you know, every time I walk in the DfE, I want to shout, you need to hear my story. But I button it up and, you know, bite my lip because I think that's not going to help. People will immediately see me as this hysterical adopter, which I can be. You know, if you want me to be hysterical, I can do that. But that's not the place.
There's a sort of an interesting mix, isn't it? Because actually, once you start doing this, you're playing a political game. Yeah. So you become a lobbyist in the same way that people are paid a massive amount of money to lobby the interests of oil companies or whatever. But you have to utilise the sort of same approach and the same set of skills, whether you're lobbying from a charity perspective, a sort of, you know, community of interest perspective, or from a commercial perspective. You've got to be able to build a relationship, build your credibility, understand what the other party wants, and to try and find a way then of helping that other party do what it wants to do, but in a way that sort of meets your interests as the lobbyist.
Yeah.
And the people who want to shout, they'll stand out in on the green outside Parliament with their banners shouting. Nobody in power will really listen to them. Those who will make the real difference are those who end up sitting in those strange little rooms at Sanctuary House or whatever, and in cafes, having quite complex discussions with civil servants who will then sort of take that forward and talk to ministers about it and so on. And that might sound like a dark art, you know, behind the scenes and all the rest of it, but that's the way the political world works if you want to bring about real meaningful change.
That's the reality, but I think that we still need activists to highlight issues that then can be piggybacked on by those lobbyists.
Completely right. Yeah, and I think the sort of activism around, the potato groups done, the activism that's been around some of the sort of child and parent violence stuff and so on. But it's how you, at the point you're making, you know, is that there's a sort of process here, isn't there? Because initially, I think things start out as a bit more sort of guerrilla, if you like, activism. Somebody's just not been listened to at all, so they start shouting about it. And do other than people listen? And I think the job of Adoption UK has been to be part activist itself, but also to sort of understand where those other things are that might not be being voiced very well at the moment, and trying to do our bit along with others to sort of bring those then into a context where they will get listened to and acted upon.
Yeah, so it's making those voices palatable. So the message may be the same, but the words are often very different, aren't they? We've all become very sensible and serious now, haven't we? So what's your third track?
Third track. Born to Run, Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll have heard of him?
I have. I've seen him on telly.
I saw him live at the Emirates two years ago.
Get you. The life of a London socialite. My last question is really, where lies the future for Adoption UK? Where lies the future for adoption? And if you could, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years, 30, 40, what? Is it withering on the vine?
I think like everything, things need to evolve. I think there will be an enduring need for some children to live with an alternative family on a permanent basis. I think that's really, really important for some children, that permanence really does mean permanence. It sounds like Brexit means Brexit. Do you know what I mean? That somebody can think that this is it for my life. And I think there are some children who are so damaged that anything short of that probably won't provide them with the continuity, because there's an extraordinary thing that many adoptive parents do in terms of sticking with things that are hugely damaging to them in terms of their own mental health, their own relationships, etc., etc. But that's because they've made that lifetime commitment through adopting a child. And I think other things that fall short of that aren't going to necessarily meet the needs of some children. I think the focus has to be on finding the right form of permanence for children, rather than just a focus on adoption being the sort of, you know, the acme of permanence options, the one everything should aspire to. And I think there has to be an evolution in away from the sort of notion of closed adoption to something that understands that for children, their histories and their previous relationships, even if they've been damaging, are significant. And at one level, that can be about a much, much more sophisticated, better approach to sort of life story work. At another level, that is, I think, a more open form of adoption. I think something else I see happening, which is important, is that many adopters see themselves working in partnership for a very long time with professionals.
Yeah.
Because their children need, you know, high intensive, often long-term therapeutic support. So I think there's something about, again, in different forms of permanence, because this would apply to special guardianship as well. Not only does this person need the sort of the motivation and the resilience and all the other qualities to parent well, but I think they need the ability to work well in partnership with professionals. Not the professionalisation of adoption, because it can never be that, but in a way, a similar shift to what we'd seen with foster care, of something that was done by people who'd had their own children and they'd grown up. So they were, you know, empty nesters, and then because they were experienced parents and that way inclined, they'd be great foster carers. And we've recognised over time, haven't we, that for the majority of children in foster care, even if it's short-term or long-term, foster carers need to devote a lot of time to it. They need to be properly trained, supported, and all the rest of it. And we sort of professionalise foster care. And that's been a response to the needs of children who end up in foster care. Particularly with the decline in the use of residential care. So we had a sort of whole crew of children we used to stick in institutions, and then suddenly we start seeing in families, and then realise we have to do more to support those families, to look after them. And I think there's a similar change in relation to what one would be looking for in terms of the qualities that an adoptive parents need. So all the sort of things that we would normally be looking for. But for some, there will be, well into their children's adulthood, a continuous relationship with professionals.
Yeah, and it may be different professionals, and we need to skill adopters up, because it is a unique relationship, and I see that often adopters just not, their innocence abroad in this world of social care, because it's a machine that moves on. It, you know, glacial place at sometimes, but they've got to find a, I've got to be able to negotiate that, whether they like it or not, and like you say, into adulthood. adult children, adult social care and learning disability, all of that kind of stuff.
Well, I think so. Yeah. Right? You know, that might sound very off-putting and all the rest of it, but what that requires on the side of professionals as well is a better way than hitherto of engaging those families and supporting them in a way that is truly supportive.
Yes.
And tries to facilitate independence for that family as much as possible, but is there almost as a sort of continuous presence, even if it's often right in the background? Because what we have at the moment is either nothing, or we have an overreaction, don't we? And people come forward with issues, and they're either not believed or listened to, or they're swept straight off down the sort of safeguarding route. So it does require a different approach from professionals as well. So this isn't all just about sort of loading stuff in terms of expectations on adopters.
No, absolutely. It is really interesting. I think, in a sense, we've boiled down the cohort of adopted children to the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And we haven't, the system is struggling to adjust to that. And also the recruitment, and I think there's an ethical, a phrase that kind of pings around my head, this idea of ethical recruitment. You know, even around child parent violence, looking at the statistics, you go, actually, people need to know what they're getting into. And then cleverer and more wise people need to be able to ask the questions, how do you communicate that? Because everyone is looking in the room saying, well, it won't be me, it'll be that couple over there, or him over there. So there's all questions around ethical preparation, around the skills and the motivations of adopters, you know, and how we prepare them. How do we prepare people who are going to, they're not going to get, they may not get family life they ever aspired or hoped to get.
Yeah, and increasingly people are adopting, aren't they, for reasons other than infertility. Yes. So the amount of people I know that have birth children and adopted children, gay couples, gay singles, you know, there isn't just one motivation to adopt. And because then, and that's because there's that diversity of reasons why people come in to adopt, I think that's incredibly important, because that does provide one with the opportunity of being able to think about, to use a marketing term, a sort of segmentation in a way.
Yeah.
You know, because we sort of package a group of children with various different needs up as sort of hard to place, and think, oh God, how are we going to find the right adopter? But what I see through my relationships with adopted family is that there are people who have actively come in to adopt children who aren't straightforward. They're not looking for the baby they never were able to have themselves.
And they bring...
They are looking to do something that is philanthropic in its nature and goes, you know, might be motivated in a similar way to the way some foster carers or particularly long-term foster carers might be motivated. And that's what they choose to do. And I think...
So it's tapping into those communities, although those resources. Because I find it really interesting that you're still so clearly quite passionate and have a lot of thoughts. I'm interested to see what your future role is going to look like. One question I did ask, what do you think there's any chance of us getting a time frame around the assessment of adoption support needs? Do you think if I lobby for that, do you think we could get it? Not me personally lobby it, but...
I think we can. I've wrote a paper for the DfE a year ago on what I thought ought to be the sort of data set to measure the effectiveness of the adoption support system. It doesn't measure
like the
quality.
Scorecards.
Yeah, so we know an awful lot about, you know, how long it takes for an adopter to be assessed, how long it takes between a child entering care and being put in placement, etc. And that has really helped, I think, the system understand where it needed to put some effort into improving, in relation to sort of removing delay and understanding the sort of flow and, you know, how you try and manage to sort of match the flow of children in the system with the flow of sort of new placements and so on. Apart from the Adoption Support Fund, we know absolutely nothing about what's going on in terms of adoption support, other than the anecdotal things that somebody's been waiting, you know, 2 years for an assessment and they still haven't had it and all the rest of it. So I think the first step is to put in place something that enables us to understand how long it is taking between someone coming forward and asking for an assessment and that assessment taking place, how long it then takes for a plan to be developed, how long it then takes for that plan to be put in place. Because there is I know at the moment there's those delays. And if support's going to be effective, it needs to be timely. So when somebody says, I need help, often they've been needing help for a while before they come forward and voice that, but they really do need help. If they've got to wait 19 months for an assessment, and then they've got to wait, you know, another 3 months after the assessment before anybody does anything with it.
That ship has sailed well and truly, hasn't it, in that case?
Yeah, and then the preferred provider's got a six-month waiting list. Yeah. You know, forget it. The ship has sailed. And, you know, that child's 2 years older and the needs haven't been met and it'll just, it'll have got worse, won't it? So that's been picked up now and some active work has been done to, which I'm still involved with, to try and better understand what's going on. And once you're able to do that, we will have then a better understanding of whether or not it's getting better because we set a baseline and we will see again, won't we, local variation. We'll see the postcode lottery thing again.
You're still saying we. You've only got 3 weeks left to be we. I mean, there's loads of issues that I would have loved to have had a conversation with you, but I'm aware we've had an hour at this. I mean, I'd love to know your views on regional adoption agencies, on the future of independent adoption agencies, which is, you know, there's lots of views about where they're going to be in 5 years' time, if they're going to be in 5 years' time. But really, I mean, I think that from my point of view, and I don't want to be sycophantic, but I think that you've done a fantastic job. I think that adoption is on the agenda like it's never been before. And we could argue the toss over whether it should be or not, but for a lot of families, that's made a big difference. So thank you. Well done. We'll let you off the tuck shop, Bill. Is there anything, you know, this is the end. It's not the end, but, you know, is there anything you would like, you know, you've really enjoyed? What's been your high point of working for Adoption UK?
Well, my high points are always thinking that I've made a difference. So I think it's a very kind word you've just said. Other people have said similar things. So, I can see the difference that I've made.
Yeah.
I hope it's an enduring difference. The risk is, you know, things change for a while and it all goes backwards again. The other thing then is working with people. And like yourself, it's been an absolute privilege to get to know people like you, Sally Donovan, really well, and a whole load of others, some of whom are my staff and volunteers, others just people I've sort of come across, who've been very generous in giving their time and talking about their experiences, which helps form that understanding about what needs to be done. So had people not been open with me and with my colleagues in the organisation, we'd never be able to make any difference because we wouldn't know what was going on. And the other side of it is that there are some hugely impressive leaders and staff out there in schools, in CAM services, and in social work, trying incredibly hard to do the right thing. The great shame is there isn't enough of them and that postcode lottery. And I don't know, think regionalisation is the complete answer to that, but something has to be done to try and find a way of getting quality up to a more consistent
level. We were talking about your high points. You've been
I think we are now getting to the point where it's through some of the understanding that professionals now have and the regionalisation approach, I think we're seeing the opportunity for some of that stuff to change. That's the high points for me have been working with adopters and their families and good professionals on some common ground.
Excellent. That's a fantastic end to it. Well, I wish you really well, and I hope that all your cycling is downhill and the wind is always on your bike, because I know you're a keen cyclist. I'm deeply jealous of your cycling plans. And I wish you well for you and your family and your hope your consultancy career and tinkering around the edges of all of these policies continues. And
I'll find a way of doing something.
Excellent. You remain a friend of all the adopters you've made friends with. Excellent. So look after yourself.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks for your time. Take care.
So there we had an interview with you. What did you make of all that then?
That one actually really got me in a lot of ways. And I think it's probably my kind of working with you that got me more than anything. He's got some really kind of valid viewpoints and a lot of things there, but I just think that it's kind of as end of, not end of careers, but you know, as career kind of pinnacles, I think that actually, regardless of what he thinks, I think it was the right place for him to be to influence what he's done. Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of pieces of the jigsaw were right for him to step into that role at the right moment.
Yeah.
And regardless of political affiliations, which I think a lot of adopters probably, my experience of adopters is they probably aren't naturally Tories through experience of having to throw themselves into care service, you know, public sector care services. But he's built a partnership with the government that's seen effective change.
And I'd agree with that completely, because you know, as someone who's a part of a same-sex couple, if you look at the changes that were made for the majority of things, were kind of labour influenced for same-sex couples and things like that. So, but you know, actually, in terms of adoption, you know, with Ed Timpson and people like that, and the current civil servants who are kind of working with us to kind of influence some of the changes, I totally agree with that. It comes down to, it doesn't come down to your party, it comes down to the person who may be working with you to influence that. So
there's a few things that Q said that I found really interesting, and one was this idea of partnership that adopters need to get their heads around, that potentially you're going to be in a long-term partnership with services and professionals, that actually for some families you're not just going to dip in for 6 months, you're going to be there potentially into adulthood, adult services, and it's not been our experience into adulthood, but it's certain, well, to young adulthood actually is our experience.
I think that's quite a tricky one, isn't it? Because I think that when you've adopted and you go past the adoption order bit, and I know this from experience, you know this from experience, and hopefully most of the listeners will know this from experience, you take a step back from the kind of professionals because you want to just see what happens. You want to live life. You want the social workers out of the way. You know, and I think that's everybody. I don't think that's just, you know, me saying that. I think that is just the way you are, because
tangible feeling of you shut the door behind the last social worker.
Exactly.
And you just, you know, you lean against it and go,
Yeah, but there does come that point, and you know, I found that, you found that.
I've even got to the end of the drive, you open the door. Yeah.
Come back. But I think that there's that kind of gap in between, and I think that's where the issue lies. I have to be perfectly frank with it, because I think there's almost an embarrassment then, after whether it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, whatever it is, I think there's almost an embarrassment to go back and ask for that support. And I think that's what we need to get over. And I think that's where we need to develop that relationship. But not just as adopters, I think local authorities and potentially regional adoption agency projects or LIVE or whatever, they need to think about that as well. They need to work on their relationships with adopters as well, so that adopters feel that they can go back without that embarrassment, without that, you know, stigma. Because you do feel as a parent that, you know, you're failing when your child is exhibiting CPV, or, you know, they're not motivated, or the, you know, whatever, they failed at education. And I think that gap really is the key to kind of not making it better, but certainly a lot less embarrassment for parents. That's what working together is for me.
And that is a big deal, I think. And just that Hugh's kind of insight to that, and he summed it up quite nicely. And I think that is a future issue for, I think, that the cohort of children that are going to be adopted and have been adopted over the last decade or so, that is their story. They will have services dipping in and out over set periods of time, over a lifetime, basically.
Definitely.
He also mentioned, he was careful, and I think he was reaching for words around the professionalisation of adopters. Which is interesting.
It is interesting.
Why are you laughing?
No, I'm laughing because actually it's something that as foster carers, which you and I have both been, I think that things have moved on for foster carers, and foster carers are recognised as professional parents. I say that with my fingers in the air, kind of doing that professional, you know, inverted commas kind of thing. And I think that that's right. And you know, some of the kind of work that I do is about trying to influence some of the kind of regional adoption agency projects that actually, when they're thinking about training and adoption support and stuff, that they're not treating adoptive parents as parents of who are not failing, but who are kind of not good parents, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And they're parents of these traumatized children, and actually, you know, most of the time we're doing a really good job. In fact, all of the time we're doing a really good job, I think. Otherwise, you know, why would the local authorities have chosen us as the parents of these children?
Yeah.
But we don't get the ongoing training. We don't have access. We have to pay for ourselves. You know, we have to blah, 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 blah. And I guess that foster carers are seen as, you know, they have to do CPD and they have to, you know, do six, whatever their agency standard is, or the statutory standard, six training courses a year or whatever.
But it's a square that can't be circled, because then if you, the minutes you say to someone you're an adopter, but you have to do CPD, then people say,
exactly. Yeah. Then so it's finding that balance, isn't it?
Because, I mean, I went to my local authority and I said, I want supervision. What I really would benefit from is if you could just keep my case open.
So
I can just, every 6 months, or even it might be 6 weeks, it might be 6 days, but I can ring someone up and go, you'll never guess what's happened now. But then I might not need you for 6 weeks or 6 months. So,
yeah.
And they said, well, you just can't do it. Either you're in or you're out. And I just thought, there's a gap. A lot of people just need a safety valve or a place. Even for us, it was the safety was that it was somewhere to record what was going on.
Yeah.
So that you're building up this story, this narrative that other professionals, if necessary, could access. So I thought that.
Well, Hugh, that's it. Yeah.
Hugh bringing that up was really interesting.
Yeah.
I think it was. You also mentioned, you know, he kind of talked a little bit about activism, and I thought that was really interesting. It was quite insightful, because I think people, the reality is, to get anything changed, it's a political game.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot, and I think Hugh's taught me a lot. I don't see Hugh anywhere near as often as I see you, but I've seen him in a lot of meetings, and I've seen him operate. In fact, what I was going to tell you was, I was in one meeting, and we were on a conference call. He was in the room, he was chairing it, and I was just sat over there. And someone on the conference call went, oh, well, we're all sat around here, middle class, whatever, just like a joke. And Hugh looked at me and he went, it's the first time Al's been called middle class. I thought to myself, he's cut me deep. If my mother was here, she would drag him over this table and thrash him in inches of life.
Yeah. With their turnips.
With their turnips, yeah. So he's very funny. But I just, what I saw from Hugh was he was someone who kind of understood that system, that to get things changed and done.
Yeah.
He understood.
Yeah.
But I know that he listened to the activists.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, I don't necessarily like the word activist, I have to be honest, because I think that kind of puts kind of some not very nice thoughts in my head. But that's just me, because that's kind of what I've been brought up with. But I think the people that do actually bring the issues to the fore are really important, because they're the people that, you know, are jumping up and down. And it's same, if you think back to the CPV thing, and how that kind of formulated and then has snowballed into one rather large snowball, as I can see from the lines under your eyes, because obviously you're not getting that much sleep, Mr. Coates. But, you know, if you think about how much momentum that's received as a result of just one conversation, and someone jumping up and down saying, actually, this is an issue.
It's just not good. But
that's what it's about, isn't it? It's about taking that kind of initial message and then turning it into something that can actually affect change. And I think that that's what I've learned. That's probably the one thing I've learned from working with a charity who actually deals with, you know, the lobbying side and what have you. It's not necessarily just about standing there and getting what you want for you. It's about getting a message across to say that actually this is a big issue, and these people or these parents or, you know, these, you know, you could say the same for LGBT rights and what have you. But that's what it's about. It's about something bigger. It's not just about one individual person.
Yeah.
You know, and 2 years ago, that would have been my view. Now, having worked in it and spoken to people and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It's just, and I think he's bang on. He's bang on with what he says. Those people we need. We need those people.
Yeah. And I'm hugely influenced by that. And it's not always easy because I think that people feel so passionate about stuff. And passionate people. When I'm passionate about stuff, I'm not easy to talk to, basically. I do have a question. So has your application form gone in?
For what? I love how you can't see it, listeners, but he's screwed up his face and is rubbing his eyes as if to say, I'm just going to mention this on the off chance that you might answer it seriously. Yeah. For what?
I love the presumption.
For cleaner at Tesco. For cleaner at Tesco.
Cleaner at Tesco. McDonald's are taking
them. Yeah, they are, yeah. Have you put in your application? That's what I want.
Actually, I applied to McDonald's when I was a children's entertainer and they didn't have me.
Funny that.
It's probably
a DBS check. No, I have not applied. It's not the right time for me. But I'm looking forward to seeing who does apply.
That's a very diplomatic answer because clearly they'll be your line manager. And they'll be going to the interview listening to this just to get some tips. They'll be going, so what is adoption about? Oh, I'll listen to this. So you'll be on it. There you go. Right, okay, tell me, what are you doing over the next couple of weeks?
So this week I've got the Navish conference I'm speaking at.
You get around.
And I do. Well, after Jane's podcast a couple of weeks ago, right on time, actually. And we're going to be talking about working together, as in working together with adoptive parents. So virtual school heads working with adoptive parents in their locality to actually work out how they can support and help and move this forward. Because obviously there's fear. Oh, excuse me. Oh, I just bounced on the podcast. Oh.
That's
yeah, thanks. Oh, I really appreciate that. So where was I before I
you told me about
myself?
Navish. You're going to do that. You can report back to us. Why don't you record your speech
put
it on the podcast?
I can. No, because it's going to be bad enough speaking.
All right, okay. What else are you doing then? In my mind, this last couple of weeks at adoption towers is like the last days of the Roman Empire with people burning evidence and
chaos. We literally are. Yeah,
There's a skip out the front and you're throwing things in and just burning them. And
excellent. And do you see this tongue in my cheek?
Yeah.
Because there's no elitism whatsoever in adoption, I don't feel. And my tongue is firmly in cheek when I'm saying all of that.
Yeah, you'll be just
having it. It needs to be. Yes. It needs to be.
I'll have to edit this down because we're just prattling on there.
Yes, you are. You will. Yeah. I'm making it very difficult for you.
Well, I'll let you know that. I'll tell you what I'm up to. I've written another article. I've written a blog. I'm doing some CPV awareness training that I am going to write tomorrow night, but I'm doing it on Friday for some social workers. And actually, that's really exciting because I'm giving it free to the social workers, but I thought actually, I need to get this top drawer and then I'm going to make sure that every blooming social worker in the land has it. And then I'm presenting to the EAG next week about adoption support. And I'm trying to use that to twist some arms to get that put as compulsory
high up the agenda as possible.
Development for social workers.
Agreed.
Who work in adoption.
Yeah, but can I just say,
with
all of that, right, and that's really all interesting, I love it all, but I actually have something really important coming up next week.
What's that?
I'm actually having a night out with Her Royal Highness, Sally Donovan, on my own, me and her.
Where are you going?
I'm not telling you, because we'll just be mobbed, because obviously, you know, she's far too famous to
We should get Sally back on, shouldn't we?
We should do.
Right, that's what we're going to do. Yeah. Get all my plans, all the really important people.
They all subsumed. It's all our queen, wa queen.
That's an Ansel.
Right. When we come off, I'm going to contact you and say, you're on the next podcast.
Yeah. Champion. Fabulous.
Right. On that note, I'm going to say goodbye.
Yes.
Literally, I'm
have a good...
slipping into a coma.
Coma through boredom, trying to keep up the banter. It's late. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well, look after yourself, Scott, and I shall speak to you soon. Stay well.
Bye.
Bye.
And you. Bye.
Bye.
You're going to have some job editing that time. Oh dear, good luck.